Welcome to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. We study change in order to make change, linking knowledge of the past to the quest for a better future. Every other week, we examine the most pressing issues of the day through a historical lens, helping us understand what happened then and what that means for us now.
Hello, I'm David Myers, host of Then and Now, the podcast of the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. One of the most vexing social problems in United States society is our country's healthcare system, which is racked by rising costs, inequitable access, and manifold inefficiencies. Unlike Canada or a number of European countries, the United States has never moved toward a single-payer system, but instead preferred a variety of private options with supplemental government programs. In California, the history of healthcare policy shows frequent oscillations between private and public healthcare programs. In a forthcoming report for the Luskin Center, Dr. Ben Stanchanovich, along with Sarah Ohanessian, Lauren Heiberg, Emiko Levings, and Emilia Fergatiotti, examine the history of healthcare policy in California, with a particular focus on Medi-Cal, the state-sponsored insurance plan introduced in 1965. In today's episode of Then and Now, we sit down to talk with Ben Stanchanovich about the findings of his team. Ben is a postdoctoral associate at the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. He's an historian of the United States with a particular interest in world domestic and international politics. He is the author of the forthcoming book from Princeton University Press, Island of Enterprise, The End of the New Deal, and the Rise of U.S. Global Policy in a World of Welfare, 1940 to 1945. Welcome to Then and Now, Ben.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thanks so much for having me. So I'm an occasional host on Then and Now, so it's very nice to be in the guest seat for once. So thanks so much for having me.
We're glad to have you on that other side. So, Ben, the story of your report, Medi-Cal and the Politics of Healthcare Policy in California, picks up in the 19th century. And really, the story begins with the founding of California as a state in the United States of America in 1850. Can you give us some sense of what healthcare policy looked like at that incipient moment in the history of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was very rudimentary in the mid-19th century. There was a state hospital that had, or a public hospital, I should say, that the Mexican government had founded in 1844 in Monterrey. But at the time of statehood, there was very little sort of medical public health infrastructure of any kind. So that became an issue very soon after statehood with the gold rush. So all of these gold rush towns are kind of springing up throughout California. This sort of transient population is causing outbreaks of communicable disease, a lot of outbreaks of cholera, of malaria. So the state responded to this with in 1855 by passing a statute. The state legislature passed a provision for the medical care of indigent sick, as they call it. So this is one of the very first such provisions in the United States that actually created public authority for the health care of people who were unable to afford it.
So it's later, however, in the early 20th century, in the progressive era, that we begin to get calls for compulsory social insurance in the United States. So presumably the regime that existed prior to this point was intended to treat only those deemed indigent or impoverished. What does compulsory social insurance mean for residents of the United States in the early 20th century and California?
Yeah, so in the early 20th century, there emerged sort of a very white Protestant middle class movement on the national level that's called for new forms of public authority to solve social problems. So the progressive movement was calling for basically social interventions, social protections, things like building and safety codes, sanitation measures, education programs, say, for immigrants to Americanize. And a big part of the progressive movement was this fairly new idea of social insurance. So a compulsory system wherein workers and employers would contribute into a fund that would protect against the risks of unemployment, of disability, of old age, and of sickness. So for the progressive movement, this was a real key to, you know, solving these problems of industrialization and solving the issue of class conflict. And this was a fairly novel idea in the United States at the time, the idea of social insurance.
And the idea of social insurance is that it would be available and accessible to all, or rather those who were perceived most socioeconomically disadvantaged.
Well, there are different forms of this, different permutations that this idea took. So some visions of it for compulsory health insurance, for example, were on the national level. So basically, essentially universal. Other forms of this concept were more narrowly geared towards the working class population, industrial workers, or means-tested programs for people below a certain income.
And this effort to create a system of social insurance reaches an interesting plateau in the state of California in 1918, when there was an effort to pass Proposition 20, which would have amended the state constitution to allow for a health insurance system in California. So can you tell us a little bit about that effort and who supported it, who opposed it, and what happened to that proposition?
Yeah, so a real driving force behind the introduction of the idea of social insurance in California is Governor Hiram Warren Johnson. And Johnson was really attracted to this idea of social insurance. And he created in 1915 a social insurance commission within his administration to study the feasibility of various forms of social insurance. And this commission really focused on the question of health insurance. So this commission did a statewide study of California. It found that sickness, that paying for medical care, was actually the largest cause of the loss of earnings for working families and one of the largest causes of poverty. So this commission recommended some form of socialized health insurance. So this got on the ballot in 1918 as Proposition 20. So a referendum that would have amended the state constitution to allow for a state health insurance system. And it was really strongly supported by women's organizations, by some of the trade unions, but it was heavily opposed by insurance companies, doctors' organizations, and major corporations, which, you know, that would be roughly the sort of pattern of interest that would continue throughout the century.
Yeah, it seems like it was that same array of forces that we see in the larger national conversation over the passage of the Social Security Act of 1935. So a bit after the failed passage of Prop 20. The United States considers the Social Security Act, the United States Congress considers the Social Security Act. What was the act and what were how are forces arrayed in the battle over that?
Yeah, so this is, you know, coming out of the Depression in the 1930s, which really caused a major shift in American political culture in thinking about poverty, unemployment, and government responsibility for aid and support of the unemployed. A real shift in thinking about deservingness. So it became clear that people in poverty and unemployment is not necessarily through a moral failing. It's often wrought through the sort of structural forces created by industrial capitalism. So in 1935, it created a system of old age insurance, unemployment insurance, and also sort of cash assistance to families with dependent children. So this act was really heavily skewed in favor of this sort of ideal of a white male breadwinner who was earning a family wage. And it, by design, excluded African Americans sort of indirectly. It excluded domestic workers and agricultural workers, for instance, who were overwhelmingly African American. And it also did not include what a lot of reformers and labor activists were hoping it would, which is a system of health insurance, which had really become the norm by this point in most major Western European countries.
So the Social Security Act is a kind of compromise with real absences of what one might consider to be a full foundation for a social welfare system.
Yeah, in a sense, I think that's right. Historians have called it, a halfway revolution, if you will. So I think a compromise is a great way to think of it. The reason why health insurance was kind of off the table is by the 1930s, the American Medical Association, the sort of trade association for doctors in the United States, really were adamantly opposed to this idea of social insurance. They felt that it would create too much government oversight, too much interference in the prerogatives of the healthcare of the medical profession. Roosevelt himself sort of declined to really push for health insurance to be included in the Social Security Act, but it became a major point of debate and contention throughout the 1940s. So it was one of the major sort of domestic social policy questions that was being debated throughout the war years and especially into the late 1940s was this question of should healthcare be included in the Social Security system?
I gather that a lot of that debate revolved around the question of what kind of health insurance system there should be. As you suggest in the report, in the 1930s and 40s, people are beginning to advocate for a single-payer system. What does that actually mean? And why did the idea arise then?
Yeah. Well, a single payer system is kind of a wonkish way of saying, a universal government coordinated, government provided system that would function, much like Social Security does. So there would be a payroll tax. Workers would pay in a certain amount. Employers would match it. In some forms of this, some proposals also called for that to be supplemented by state, general state revenue, by state taxation. So why was this becoming a central issue then in the 1940s? Well, I think for a few reasons. One is simply that the New Deal had really expanded the sort of scope of federal authority and created possibilities that had not existed just a few decades before. Another is transnational sort of thinking about what would the post-war world look like in industrial democracies and in Europe social insurance was really at the heart of these new welfare states that countries were creating in Europe, especially the labor government in the late 1940s and in the UK. Another reason is a strong labor movement was emerging in the 1930s and 1940s, especially in the CIO, the Industrial Labor Federation, that was emerging as a very powerful political force. And they had health insurance as one of their key sort of demands on the state.
So, Ben, how well-developed would you say was the United States as a welfare state, as a social welfare system under FDR, say, relative to what one saw at the time in Europe? How would you rate the United States?
How would I rate the United States? I think that Western welfare states were really rooted in the idea of social and economic rights as human rights. And I think that the American welfare state never became as sort of redistributionist as a lot of Western European countries did, and as much as progressives and the labor movement hoped that it would in the 1940s. Social insurance itself is in a sense a redistributive social program. It redistributes wealth from high income to the bottom, but never on the scale that many Western European countries
did. So, if the hallmark of a functioning social welfare state be a single payer system, can you give us a sense of when the conversation over single-payer system was taken seriously? What are the points along the way when that issue, a single-payer system, was discussed most seriously? Is it in this period in the 30s and 40s and that's it, never thereafter?
Yeah, I think so. The 1940s is really the apex of this really being on the table in the United States. There was a series of bills called the Wagner-Murray-Dingell bills, calling for healthcare to be included in the Social Security system. So really strongly supported by labor, strongly supported by progressive organizations, and adamantly opposed by the American Medical Association and by corporate.
Yeah, and what you show in the report is that in the California version of the debate over a single-payer system, we see not only this traditional division of labor with labor on one side and the California Medical Association on the other, we see the introduction of a new player, which is a PR campaign in the form of Whitaker and Baxter. Can you tell us about them and what's novel and important about that?
Yeah. So what's really interesting, I think, about about California in this period is that it really becomes kind of a laboratory, a microcosm, if you will, for these broader national level debates over universal healthcare. In the early mid 1940s, Governor Earl Warren, who would go on to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he was a moderate Republican, and he actually supported some aspects of the New Deal, some sort of progressive measures, and one of them was universal health care on the state level. So Warren introduced a plan for a single player system for the state of California. So in sort of a microcosm of these broader national debates, the California Medical Association was really, really adamantly opposed to this. So they hired a public relations team called Whitaker and Baxter, a husband and wife team. And the California Medical Association poured, massive, massive amounts of funding into this campaign led by Whitaker and Baxter that depicted Warren's plan as sort of a socialistic ploy that would lead to really excessive taxation, excessive state regimentation. And so the American Medical Association on the national level sort of picked up on this. They hired Whitaker and Baxter based on their experience here in California in defeating Warren's plan, which was defeated by the late 1940s, and sort of applied these techniques on the federal level. So Truman in the late 1940s made universal health care one of the really key components of his domestic agenda. And the American Medical Association sort of used these tactics that were honed in California to launch a really aggressive public relations campaign and lobbying campaign against them.
That was successful in beating back the idea of a single payer system, both at the state level and at the national level. And shortly thereafter, we see the rise to prominence of an alternative, which is the prepaid health insurance plan. Can you tell us about that as an alternative to the single payer system, and maybe talk about its most important institutional embodiment, which is Kaiser Permanente?
So prepaid medical plans are basically what they sound like. Instead of paying for one medical service at a time, it is a system wherein you pay in advance for a sort of prescribed set of services. And in the late 1930s, early 1940s, the Kaiser Company under Henry J. Kaiser sort of picked up on this plan and began offering it to their employees through a really sort of novel, unique system that combined prepayment with group practice and medical facilities sort of owned and operated by the plan itself. So by 1945, it became open to the public, and Kaiser Permanente, as it came to be called, quickly became the largest prepaid system of medical insurance in the United States, and it would serve to be the primary model of what we know of today as the prepaid HMO system, the health maintenance organization system, or the managed care system. So private insurance is of this model is really sort of taking hold in California and in the United States on the whole during this period as well. And so this is what the American Medical Association and opponents of a government system are really latching on to this system, employer provided system of prepaid healthcare. So this is crucial to the AMA and to Whitaker and Baxter's campaign, which had the tagline, the voluntary way is the American way. Right, so this is voluntary. It's part of the employment relationship, and eventually unions. Once it becomes clear that there's not going to be a system of universal health care in the United States, they start really demanding this from their employers. This kind of prepaid plan. So it became really institutionalized through collective bargaining in the late 1940s into the 1950s. So by the 1950s, employer provided health insurance is really solidified and entrenched as the primary method of healthcare financing and delivery in the United States.
And thinking of the emergence of Kaiser Permanente in this prepaid approach, I'm wondering if you think of California as an innovator in government healthcare policy, or a bellwether of existing trends, as reactive. How would you situate California in this longer history of healthcare policy in the United States?
I think that in many cases, California has been kind of a laboratory or a model, or in some cases a cautionary precedent, if you will, for states on the national level. It's as one of the largest states and largest healthcare systems, It has been, you know, really, really crucial to the national conversation. And that's one thing that this report found again and again is, you know, California as, really sort of a catalyst for policy debates over healthcare at various points.
Okay. And so maybe that helps us understand the importance of the main topic of the research paper that you have produced with your team of colleagues, and that is the advent of Medi-Cal in 1965, or CalMed as it was originally known. What was the aim of CalMed or Medi-Cal in light of the various regimes that you've identified, private insurance, prepaid health insurance, et cetera?
Well, so by the 1950s, universal health care, you know, the Truman Plan is really a dead letter. And again, you know, private employer plans solidified through collective bargaining is really the primary form of health insurance. So progressive organizations, unions, reformers start to really sort of narrow their scope in thinking about what government intervention into the healthcare system can look like, and they started to focus more and more in the 1950s on plans for public government plans for the poor, the very poor, and B, the elderly, old people. So these are people who are typically not covered through employer plans. And they're also populations, you know, from an actuarial standpoint that insurers don't really want to cover anyway, because they're too high risk. So into the 1960s, the Lyndon Johnson administration really sort of picked up on this idea as part of the Johnson administration's sort of agenda for a great society that included the war on poverty, immigration reform, civil rights. So this led to, in 1965, the passage of Medicare, which is a federally funded and administered system for the elderly, and Medicaid which is a means-tested program administered by the states with federal funding for low-income people. So in California, this became the Medi-Cal system. So Medi-Cal became operational in 1965, 1966, and it immediately covered about 1.1 million Californians, so about very substantial proportion of the population. And it was, originally one of the most generous Medicaid plans in the United States. It offered drugs, physical therapy, radiation therapy, psychiatric services, even in its original form, dental care. But it's important to note that the emergence of Medi-Cal corresponded with the election of Ronald Reagan as governor in 1967. So just 1 or 2 years after Medi-Cal became operational. And, you know, really central to Reagan's agenda as a government, as a governor, as it would be when he reached the White House, was trying to limit, roll back, what he saw as welfare programs, whether that be programs like aid to families with dependent children, so cash assistance, or means-tested healthcare programs like Medi-Cal.
Right, and Reagan said of Medi-Cal, unless Medi-Cal is revived and revamped, it not only can but most assuredly will bankrupt our state.
Yeah, so Medi-Cal for Reagan became really central to this sort of vision of limited state intervention, of austerity. And so, Reagan was really intent on cutting cutting back the program as much as he could, and becoming really central to that idea in the early 1970s, late 60s, early 70s, was this idea of the health maintenance organization, the idea of prepaid plans that were, you know, often private for-profit companies that would use Medicaid funding to administer services. So for Reagan and his advisors, this was a great way to simultaneously, you know, reduce costs, limit Medicaid costs, increase efficiency, but also channel government funds into the private sector, into these sort of private for-profit entities. And this was a strategy that was, you know, becoming very appealing to Republicans and conservatives on the federal level as well. But again, this is another instance where this was really innovated first in California by the Reagan administration.
And given the array of options that exist, what do you think the liabilities or deficiency of the prepaid model are? That is to say, that model that goes by the name HMO, because in today's world, given escalating health costs, many people see that form, particularly Kaiser Permanente, as the model of quality healthcare at an affordable price point. And I'm curious how you see that model set against the long-durée perspective on government healthcare policy.
So, yeah, I mean, there's no question that systems like Kaiser Permanente, keep costs down. They sort of rein in medical expenditure. But what that leads to, especially in for-profit HMOs or medical managed care organizations, is an incentive to kind of ration care. And that's really what started to emerge in California in the 1970s. So there was a big LA Times expose on this in the early 70s. They called, you know, this was the second gold rush, as the LA Times put it. So it was a huge explosion of the privatization of services being administered with public funds.
Yeah. So, and tell us what impact Prop 13, sort of that monumentally significant proposition passed, I believe, in 1978, had on state healthcare policy.
Yeah. So Proposition 13 created a cap on property taxes, essentially. And historians see this as a real sort of turning point in American political culture, a significant milestone in the conservative revolution of the late 70s, 1980s. So what this did in California is it really, really gutted government revenue really, really quickly. And it put a lot of strain and pressure on state and local hospital systems and on the funding of Medi-Cal. So what the response was from the state was to end this category that California had created that a lot of most states did not have, which is what was called the medically indigent adult category. So this is maybe single people, adults without dependent children. Unlike most states, they were eligible to be covered under Medicaid. So the state ended this category in 1982, 1983. Pretty much overnight, 270,000 people just instantly kind of lost their insurance in the early 80s. So this led to a series of real crises in California. One was that people increasingly turned to emergency rooms in order to get their care, which led to a phenomenon called patient dumping, in which private hospitals would dump their emergency patients onto public ones. And this was, at the same time as the AIDS crisis, increasing gun violence, increasing homelessness, increasing drug abuse. So Prop 13 really led to a real sort of retrenchment and period of austerity in California in terms of Medi-Cal.
And the idea of a single payer system returned to the agenda in Proposition 186. What were the circumstances around that?
Yeah, so Proposition 186 was emerged in 1994 in the context of these broader sort of national debates over healthcare. So this is when Clinton was advancing his sort of neoliberally inflected vision of universal healthcare, the idea of managed competition that would drive down healthcare costs, and this is a response to really dramatically increasing rates of being uninsured in the United States in the late 80s into the 90s, but so the Clinton plan was pretty soundly defeated in the by the mid 90s. So this led to again a push to implement some sort of a single payer system on the state level, which led to Proposition 186, which was one of several sort of referendums to create a comprehensive single payer system that would be financed out of a new payroll tax, tobacco taxes, new income taxes, and so this is one of several such proposals that cropped up throughout the 90s into the 2000s. In 2006, a similar bill actually passed both houses of the legislature, but this was Senate Bill 840 in 2006, but it was eventually actually vetoed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. So one of many sort of efforts to implement a single payer system on the state level.
One of the important groups whom advocates have been concerned about are undocumented immigrants in this country, and the state in particular, who become an increasingly important constituency for healthcare providers to engage with. How did state healthcare policy deal with the growing presence of undocumented residents of the state?
Yeah, so especially over the course of the 1990s and 2000s, California really underwent a really profound demographic transformation. So in 1990, about 7.6 million Californians identified as Hispanic, Latinx, of any race. And by 2010, that number had almost doubled to 14 million. So an increasing percentage of Medi-Cal patients during this period were Latinx, but the undocumented population was completely shut out of the Medi-Cal system, of the Medicaid by federal design. So the original legislation that created Medicaid limited federal funding solely to citizens and lawfully admitted legal residents. So California, again, was really a sort of innovator here in expanding coverage to the undocumented population. So again, they couldn't use federal funding, but they could use state funding to fold more and more undocumented people under the under Medi-Cal coverage. So in 2015, the California State Legislature expanded coverage to children, to undocumented children, one of the first states to do so. Just last year, 2023, California became the first state in the country to extend Medicaid coverage to the entire eligible population, regardless of documentation status.
So what does that tell us in this long history that you chronicle, a 170-year history of state healthcare policy, with increasing attention in, of late to the status of undocumented residents of the state? So are there trend lines that you can identify that suggest you the arc of history is bending towards more justice and equity, or would that be too premature a conclusion to arrive at?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, one that we really grappled with while we were writing this report and thinking about conclusions that we could draw from it and policy recommendations that we could draw. I think there's little question that the Medi-Cal system has really dramatically increased access to care for Californians and especially Californians of color, of vulnerable populations. By the same token, I think it would be a mistake to view this history as kind of a chronicle of linear progress, right? Of ever more expansive coverage that is bringing ever more people into the Medicaid system. I think that one thing that the history shows is that, you know, on the contrary, Medi-Cal has been the history of Medi-Cal has been marked by numerous sort of fluctuations periods of retrenchment and retraction of coverage and funding as well as expansion. I think one great example of that is the 1982 ending of the medically indigent adult category that immediately disqualified over a quarter of a million Californians. And that's one thing that's a great example of what history can really directly teach us as we're thinking about current policy questions, when we as we're grappling with this question of Medicaid unwinding after the pandemic. So Medicaid was expanded to or modified to allow for continuous eligibility throughout the pandemic. So basically, if you were on Medicaid, you did not have to prove on a yearly basis throughout the pandemic emergency that you were still eligible. You remained eligible. So this continuous coverage provision ended last year ended in California in over the summer. So millions and millions of Californians have lost coverage through this this Medicaid unwinding. What's particularly distressing about it is that a large proportion of people who are losing coverage it's not because they're not eligible, it's because of quote unquote procedural reasons. They have failed to return paperwork or filled out paperwork incorrectly. And this is especially true of people in really dire poverty or people who are not native English speakers. So again, we have this situation in which many millions of people are losing coverage, and we have direct evidence of what that means in California. It means really dramatic and demonstrable adverse health outcomes quite quickly. So,
and so as we wrap up, can you give us a sense of where you think we need to go? What recommendations emerge out of your report that you feel might be achievable or must be achieved in order to allow for a more equitable society?
Yeah, so that's a great question. A few things. One again is I think you could divide the sort of lessons that the history can teach into kind of two camps. One is sort of immediate acute crises that we're facing here in California. Again, the Medicaid unwinding crisis is a particularly urgent one, but also the massive rise of the unhoused population in recent years. But there are also, sort of more sort of structural, longstanding issues that need to be addressed. And one is the question of managed care reform. So 90% of the Medi-Cal population is now covered under a managed care health maintenance organization or the sort of prepaid healthcare plan that uses Medicaid funds, and many of these are operating on a for-profit basis, and there continue to be real questions in terms of quality of care in managed care organizations, a lack of accountability, and a lack of transparency. I think one thing that we really need to keep in mind as we think about managed care and the health maintenance organization question is this came, especially in the state of California, it arose as a very specific sort of political, ideological project under the Reagan governorship in the late 1960s, early 1970s, as a means of imposing austerity and as a means of channeling public money into private for-profit healthcare entities. I think what that shows is that we often I think we can have a tendency to view systems like managed care as kind of inevitable, intractable. I think taking a historical perspective can really denaturalize questions like that of managed care. Showing that they arose not necessarily out of pragmatic necessity, but for political purposes. So I think that's crucial perspective as we evaluate their current operation and their how we should address them in the future.
Well, with that helpful reminder of the political nature of healthcare policy debates, we want to thank you, Ben, for making time to be with us to talk about your report, Medi-Cal and the Politics of Healthcare Policy in California, which will be forthcoming from the Luskin Center for History and Policy. Thanks for being with us.
Great, David. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. You can learn more about our work or share your thoughts with us at our website, luskincenter.history.ucla.edu. Our show is produced by David Myers and Rosalind Campbell, with original music by Daniel Reichman. Special thanks to the UCLA History Department for its support, and thanks to you for listening.